Okay, so we're reading from Mark 15, verse 1. Very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. So they bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you the king of Jews?" asked Pilate. "You have said so," Jesus replied. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they are accusing you of." But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. Now it was the custom at the festival to release a prisoner whom the people requested. A man called Barabbas was in prison with the rebels who had committed murder in the uprising. The crowd came up and asked Pilate to do for them what he usually did. "Do you want me to release to you the king of Jews?" asked Pilate, knowing it was out of self-interest that the chief priest had handed Jesus over to him. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd to get Pilate to release Barabbas instead. "What shall I do then with the one you call the king of the Jews?" Pilate asked them. "Crucify him," they shouted. "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." Wanting to satisfy the crowd, Pilate released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is, the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, the King of Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spat on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it, and they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. It was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified 2 rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. "Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of those standing near heard this. They said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." Someone ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a staff, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in 2 from top to bottom, and when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger, and of Joseph, and Solomon. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. It was preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath. So as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. So Joseph brought some linen cloth, took down the body, wrapped it in linen, and placed it in the tomb. Cut out of rock. Then he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb. They asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they have laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he has told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid.
Well, every day when I come into uni, I leave my house and I walk down the road, down the hill to the West Leadville train station. And I walk under the underpass and I hang a right and I walk all the way out to Subiaco. I catch the bus in from there. And as I walk along from West Leadville to Subiaco, I often see graffiti. And I wander along and I sometimes see council crews cleaning it up. And I think to myself, who does this? Who spends their time going around writing graffiti, leaving tags everywhere? And why? It's so dumb. Like, what is achieved by it? It seems to me that you'd have to be pretty silly, pretty foolish to devote your life to writing graffiti. But then if there's two graffiti writers, a lot of people think that about Christians too. Why would you devote your life to something like this? And especially, why would you devote your life to worshipping someone who was crucified? And what a bizarre idea. In fact, as it turns out, the very first depiction that we have of Jesus' crucifixion is a piece of graffiti. Here it is. It's from a Roman schoolroom about 1800 years ago. And scratched into the wall, and you can see there, there's a man worshipping someone on the cross who's got a donkey's head. And underneath in Greek, it says, "Alexandros worships his God." And you can see what it's saying, can't you? That any god who goes and gets himself crucified must be an ass. What an idiot. And anyone who worships this God, they've got to be stupid. How daft do you have to be to go and worship a crucified man? Why would you worship someone who died that way? Because the Jews thought that crucifixion was sort of the idea that you would worship a God who'd been crucified. That's blasphemous. And the Romans just thought it was laughable. Even Muhammad, the great founder of Islam, writing 500 years after the event, blatantly in contradiction of the eyewitnesses, just cannot believe that Jesus could possibly have been crucified. It's too outrageous that such a great prophet would die in this way. He writes in the Quran, "The Jews declared, 'We've put him to death.'
the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the apostle of God. But they did not kill him, nor did they crucify him, but they thought they did. See, how could Jesus possibly be crucified? It's impossible. There must be some other explanation. It must be a case of mistaken identity. Because worshipping a crucified Messiah is just too stupid for words. In fact, the cross has always looked stupid. You start to see it here in Mark chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. Very early in the morning, the chief priests and the elders, the teachers of the law, the whole Sanhedrin, reached a decision. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. "Are you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. I guess king of the Jews is probably how the Jewish leaders have explained the concept of Messiah to him. Pilate doesn't know what a Messiah is, but he knows what a king is. Now, this guy who's claiming to be the Messiah, he's claiming to be the king of the Jews. So he asks him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "Yes, it is as you say." Now think about that for a moment. Are you the king of the Jews? Because usually kings have kind of like palaces and armies. And usually they have nice robes and jewellery and a crown and stuff like that. You kind of look like a peasant. You kind of look like a carpenter from the back walks of Galilee. Did you know you smell of it? Do you know that you've been handed over by your own people? Are you the king of the Jews? Come on. I mean, if you were Jesus' lawyer, you would be seriously considering an insanity claim, wouldn't you? Oh, this is crazy. How can Jesus be claiming that he is the king of the Jews? In fact, it's so bizarre that no one in the entire episode of Jesus' death takes him seriously. Pilate doesn't. I mean, he does call him king of the Jews, but he's just winding up with Jewish leaders. The soldiers certainly don't take Jesus seriously. They all think he's mad. "How are you king of the Jews? How you doing?" They take him away into the praetorium. Oh, great king, you seem to be missing a few things. You seem to be missing your robe. Here, let us give you a robe. King, you seem to be without your crown. Well, here we go. You know, it's not much. It's just some thorns that will twist together, and there's your crown. They take a stick and they hit him over the head like with a scepter. "I now pronounce you king of the Jews. Let's anoint this king of the Jews." They spit on him. They bow down. They take the knee and pay homage to him. "Great one. King, you're so wonderful." And then they get bored with it and they take him out and crucify him. It's pathetic. It's ridiculous. The guy can't even carry his own cross. They have to drag in this other guy, Simon, who's coming from the fields, and get him to carry it for him. They nail him up, naked, helpless, humiliated. King of the Jews, indeed. Come on. What kind of king gets himself crucified? What kind of God would get himself crucified? Those who pass by hurl insults at him. "So you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." Oh look, he saved others, but he can't save himself. Oh, come down, king. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross so that we may see and believe. Even the thieves who are crucified with him insult him. "King of the Jews, you're right. Some Messiah he turned out to be. Doesn't exactly look like the Romans are fleeing in terror, does it? He's supposed to be bestest buddies with God. Keeps calling himself the Son of God. Keeps calling God his Father. Well, it kind of looks like Daddy's done a runner, doesn't it? Where is he now? King of the Jews indeed. What an ass. And anyone who worships him would have to be a fool. There are plenty of people think that way now. They're happy to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, even a revolutionary crushed by the system. But as king? As God? Don't be an ass. Don't be stupid. Last semester I was chatting with a few of the atheists in the Atheist and Agnostic Society during Faith Week. They had a stall up on the open lawn. And we were chatting, and one of the guys said to me, "Well, if God is real, why doesn't he just appear? Why doesn't he just show himself to me so that I can know that he exists and that I believe?" That seems like a reasonable request, doesn't it? But why doesn't God just show up? Because if he did, it would solve a lot of problems, wouldn't it? Answer a lot of questions. But when you think about it, it's actually not quite that easy. Because if God did just show up, how would you know it was him? How would you know it wasn't just some other spiritual being, an angel or a demon? How would you know that you weren't just hallucinating or losing your mind? Some people say that God reveals himself through events. And you sort of see that a bit in the Bible. But the problem is that events aren't clear. How do you know that this event is done by God? Other people say, well, that's why we've got the Bible. So we can actually read what God says, and he can interpret the events for us. But the problem with that is, how do you know that the Bible is actually God's word? How do you know that it really is God talking? And how do you know that interpretations of events that have happened are genuine interpretations by God and not just sort of after the fact rationalisations of it? How does God reveal himself? Well, he seems to reveal himself in lots of ways in the Bible, but it seems like the main way he does it is by making promises and then fulfilling them. He makes promises, and then sometimes hundreds, thousands of years down the track, he keeps them. How does that help to reveal God? Well, it helps to reveal God because only the true God, only the living God, is in control of history. Only the true and living God can make those promises hundreds, thousands of years before and then control them, control all the events so that they come about just as he promised they would. When you meet the guy who controls all of history, you know that you've met the true and living God. All right, with that in mind, come back with me to Mark's account of Jesus' death. We've left Jesus hanging on the cross, mocked and ridiculed. But reading through it, what do you notice about Mark's account? What do the people who are there at the time notice? What strikes them as odd? Well, have a look with me at verse 3. The chief priests accused him of many things. So again, Pilate asked him, "Aren't you going to answer? See how many things they're accusing you of." But Jesus still made no reply, and Pilate was amazed. So it is pretty unusual for someone who is on trial for their life to make no answer. It's even stranger when that person is actually innocent, when all the witnesses don't line up. Why is Jesus silent? Why doesn't he answer them? His silence is particularly odd. There he is, accused by the chief priests, the elders, the teachers of the law. Pilate is puzzled by it. Why doesn't he answer? Well, It is odd, but if you know your Old Testament, then Jesus' silence speaks volumes. So come with me to Isaiah 53. You've got it on your handout there. And it's written about 700 years before Jesus' death. Isaiah 53, verse 1. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been extended? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Then down to verse 7. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Do you see what's happening here? 700 years before the death of Jesus, God wrote about it. He told us what would happen, that his servant would be despised and rejected by people, led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, he did not open his mouth. Cut off from the land of the living and assigned a grave with the wicked, though he'd done no violence, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And then in Mark chapter 15, verse 33, darkness comes over the land from midday until 3 p.m. And the people at 3 p.m. are struck by Jesus' cry, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Some of them are confused by it. They think he's calling Elijah, Eli, Eli. But Mark says, no, not Eli, Eli. Eloi, Eloi. My God, why have you forsaken me? What's going on? Has Jesus given up? Has he finally lost faith in his Father? Is he in despair? No. He's quoting the first line of Psalm 22, written by David, the King of Israel, the Messiah, about 1,000 years earlier. Have a look at it with me. Psalm 22, verse 1. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? Oh, my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer, by night, and am not silent. Verse 15, my strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them. They cast lots for my clothing. So what are we dealing with here at the death of Jesus? Is this just a pointless bit of graffiti on the subway of history? No. It's something much more impressive than that. It's God's ultimate masterpiece. Something that he's been working on for centuries, for thousands of years. Something that he's been guiding all of history towards. To this moment, it is nothing less than the revelation of the true and living God. Because who else could make these promises 700, 1,000 years earlier and bring them about so precisely? Down to the method of Jesus' death, they pierced my hands and my feet. To the behaviour of the soldiers at the cross, dividing his garments and casting lots for his clothing. Who could bring this about so precisely, so brilliantly, that on his masterpiece is the description of it, put there by the Roman government?
the King of the Jews. Who could bring this about to make a Roman centurion the tour guide to the masterpiece of God? Surely this man was the Son of God. Who could do that? Well, only the true and living God.
Only the God who is in control of all history. Alexamenos worships his God. You bet he does. The cross looked foolish to his classmates, but Alexamenos knew that at the cross he had met God, the true God. The God who is the author of the scriptures and the Lord of history. And more than that, he knew that at the cross he had met his Saviour. So come back with me to Isaiah 53 verse 4. Isaiah 53 verse 4. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds we are healed. We all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. See, the cross, God's masterpiece, is not just him revealing himself. It's not just God writing his tag. It's his masterpiece of salvation. Because in all the ugliness and brutality of an innocent man nailed to a cross, there is something incredibly beautiful. It is the revelation of God and his salvation. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. When you look at the cross and you see Jesus hanging there, bloody, bruised, tortured, torn apart from his Father, that should be you. You are the one who should be there. But instead it's Jesus. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds we are healed. Freed from sin, freed from condemnation, freed from the wrath of God. Very early Sunday morning, a small group of women who had been following Jesus from Galilee came to the tomb to finish preparing his body for burial. And as they walk along at dawn, they wonder who will be able to roll away the stone from the doorway of the tomb. Who will enable them to get in to prepare his body for burial? Looking up, they're shocked to discover that it's already gone. They enter the tomb to find a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right-hand side. And he says, "Don't be alarmed. You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He's risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." See, God's masterpiece, the fulfillment of his promises, didn't end with the death of his suffering servant, the King of the Jews. God had always promised much more than that. Have a look at it again in Isaiah 53, verse 10. "Though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days. And the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied." Psalm 22, he has not despised or disdained the suffering of the afflicted one. He's not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. God's masterpiece didn't end with the death of his son, but with his raising from the dead, just like God had always promised centuries before. Resurrected to be Lord of the universe. In October 2013, a man set up a store in New York, just on a street.
selling pieces of graffiti artwork. You can see them there, $60 a pop. He sold 7 paintings over the day, $420 worth. Most people just walk past. It's just a stupid graffiti. Too expensive. What kind of idiot would buy that? What they didn't know was that they were pieces by the British graffiti artist Banksy. He set it up as a prank. You could have bought every piece there on that stall for $2,000. They were worth over $500,000. Now imagine you had walked past that stall that day and thought, how stupid, what a waste of money. Wouldn't you regret that for the rest of your life? And if you had recognised it, wouldn't you have done everything you could to buy as many as possible, to grab it? You'd spend all your money, every last cent. You'd be on the phone to your friends and you'd say, get down here now, you won't believe what's happened. Trust me, this is going to be the best investment of your life. You will never regret this. This is unbelievable, but it's true.
So the cross looks foolish, doesn't it? At first glance. But when you take another look, when you know the artist, it's not foolish. It's brilliant. Alexamenos worships his God in spite of the mockery of his classmates. And you know what? Alexamenos still worships his God.
Not in some kind of abstract way, oh, his graffiti still exists, but in reality. Because Alexamenos, the God that he worships, was his saviour, the conqueror of death, the Lord of the universe. Alexamenos still worships his God in the heavenly realms, and he will for eternity. Jesus was no ass. Alexamenos was no fool. Alexamenos worships his God. Don't you want to join him?